Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
That was the Works Projects Administration, the WPA. And they weren't just building that heavy infrastructure. They were doing that, the big bridges and tunnels and airports and seaports and hospitals. They did all that. But they also employed hundreds of thousands of writers and artists and musicians. And they were producing culture, basically. And we don't do that anymore. We've got the resources, and there's so much more that we should be doing.
Today's guest on It's Our Money is a law and finance professor and candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives, Tim Canova, who's returning to our airwaves this week and brings intellectual and political insight into our monetary system and its overlords at the Federal Reserve, as well as the ostensible overlords of the Fed, our elected representatives. It's time to dive into the hard realities of hard cash. Hello and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute and co-host of this program, back this week with a look into some of the news that has developed in recent weeks following the fires, floods, hurricanes, and other devastating disasters that have laid waste to so much. How can we address the costs of rebuilding? Where will the money come from? And what should be done about all that lost equity? What role should our government be playing? And why shouldn't our government take the position of aggressive financier of recovery, just like FDR did back for us in the days of economic devastation of the 20th century? We'll hear from Ellen about these subjects and discuss some of her pivotal articles that she wrote in recent weeks. And then we'll talk with Tim Canova about his efforts to bring public interest back into not just our body politic, but also the management of our central money system. So first, let's connect with Ellen and see what's going on with our money.
Well, Ellen, you know, life is very interesting. So many things happening, some enormously tragic, some very exciting. But money has certainly been leading the topic categories in so many ways. And you've just provoked really very insightful thinking around problem solving around two particular areas that we wanted to touch on today. One being how to respond to the cost of the tragedies that are emerging with the environment relative to floods and hurricanes and now fires. And secondly, you know, how to provide the financing for another disaster, people not having money and the need to, or jobs even as technology comes along, and the need to, perhaps need, to provide basic income. You did two great articles, and which one comes to mind first?
Well, we are shocked with the news of the fires up in Northern California, which are unprecedented. I mean, we've never had fires like that, and just sort of out of the blue. And people apparently weren't insured in that area in Sonoma. They didn't have that kind of insurance because it was like a suburban community. It was, they didn't expect that they would need it, I guess. So I wrote an article on Puerto Rico, which was subject to Hurricane Irma, and I think there was another hurricane that hit there as well. Anyway, these were also shocking things that are worse than, I mean, it was the worst devastation that Puerto Rico had ever had. But before the hurricane, they already were in bankruptcy. I mean, they already can't pay their bills. And the problem is the bondholders that have lent all this money to them that's kept them afloat for quite some time, half the bondholders are the vulture funds, which bought them up on the cheap. And these are not people that we sympathize with, and it would be fine if they were defaulted on. But, you know, from our moralistic perspective. But the other half of the bondholders are or could be retired people, pensioners, pension funds, funds of all sorts. Of course, even they were buying risky bonds, and they probably knew it. They're getting a good interest rate because it is a risky bond. But still, you're putting people's savings at risk. And so you don't want to just say, well, just let them default on these bonds. So what do you do? President Trump, when he was visiting, he said, you know, these bonds aren't going to get paid. And he was saying he didn't know if it was Goldman Sachs or who, but those, it just wasn't going to get paid. And that shocked the reporters and shocked everybody, shocked the bond market, I guess, because municipal bonds virtually are always paid. You know, it's one of those things,
right,
that the bondholders get paid first, and if you have to squeeze some austerity out of the citizens, that's just the way it's done. They get squeezed.
Right.
But in this case, it's not even a question of squeezing. There's just nothing more to squeeze. I mean, the island was flattened by these hurricanes. So what do you do? So what I was just suggesting was a proposal made by Goldman Sachs, funnily enough, for Italy, when Italy had this problem of they had four bankrupt banks, and the EU had this new policy, the bail-in policy, where before a government could bail out its banks, you would have to bail in the bondholders. Well, it turns out in Italy, the bondholders were these small mom-and-pop savers who had been sort of fraudulently induced to buy these bonds, thinking that they were just basically buying CDs or, you know, basically just had these safe bonds. And they didn't know that they could be confiscated if the bank went bankrupt. And one man committed suicide, and I wrote an article about that quite a while ago. So what Goldman Sachs said was, well, if you just did 9 more months of quantitative easing, if the ECB just did 9 extra months of quantitative easing, to just put those bonds on the balance sheet of the ECB, that they were already buying government bonds, well, just buy the debt of these banks, and that would solve the problem.
Yeah.
So in the case of Puerto Rico, our Federal Reserve was doing $85 billion a month of buying up mortgage-backed securities and federal securities at the end in their QE3, their last QE program. So it would only take 1 month to rescue Puerto Rico. All you have to do is just fire up the
digital printing press.
Yeah, the virtual printing press is 1 more month, and you could save Puerto Rico. Then the question is, but then won't everybody want to be bailed out? Everybody's going to say, well, what about us? We've got problems too. And can that, at some point, are you not going to create inflation or whatever? But it seems to me, yes, you should be able to not necessarily like totally bail them out. But for California example, or for all the states that are having infrastructure problems, they should be getting interest-free loans. Why not? The banks got $29 trillion of nearly interest-free loans to bail them out when their liquidity dried up, when they couldn't get it from the repo market. And it seems like the state and local governments are less culpable than the banks. I mean, they were victims of this whole banking crisis. So there's no reason why they shouldn't be at least be able to get interest-free loans or nearly very cheap loans instead of 4 to 6 or 8%, depending on the type of bond that they're doing now.
Right.
So that would be my proposal there. Use quantitative easing that we actually need to get more money in the system. And then the question is, wouldn't that be inflationary? No, because if you put more money into the system, you're paying. So on the question of basic income guarantee for people, that you can make the same argument that if you give them the money, let's say you gave them $1,000 a month, that this creates demand, and then the demand creates jobs, and the money changes hands. In a good economy, the money changes hands 7 times, and each time it changes hands, the recipient will pay taxes on that money, that, you know, assuming it's for goods and services, GDP, you pay taxes on it. Average tax rate on GDP is 26%. So a dollar, if it actually changed hands 7 times, and if all those recipients paid taxes on it, you could actually get almost $2 back in taxes. You could get more back than you put out. But of course, that would be in an ideal situation. And in fact, you've got deductions and a lot of money gets lost. I mean, it doesn't all, they don't all pay that sort of tax rate. But you would, anyway, get the money back up to some point. I mean, of course, there's at the point where you see that you're creating inflation, that's where you stop. But you could generate a lot more money, put a lot more money into the system. You've got a lot of people out of work. that it would be happy to either have a job or to have a better job or to have their time put more efficiently to work. There are all kinds of machines that either are already created or could be created that could do lots more work than they're doing, and you don't even have to pay them overtime or vacations or any of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of potential for productivity that we haven't tapped. But to get those engines going, you've got to put the money out there first.
Now, relative to Puerto Rico, they owe about $75 billion. And, of course, they've got nothing to work with there other than tropical environment, some ocean front at this point. It's a complete devastation. They owe $75 billion in these obligations, many of them, as you said, municipal or general obligation bonds for a variety of things. Half of that money is interest. In other words, it's just the fee that they have on the books to pay. So in other words, if you just said, okay, you guys are broke, you've had a hard time, we're going to cut you a break, we'll just call it even. And that $33 billion that you owe us in interest, we'll just call that just business of hard knocks for us. We'll move on to some other place. That seems to me to be quite a reasonable expectation, certainly perhaps a more sensitive one to human conditions. They need about $100 billion to recover, however they're going to be able to recover. But here again we see how money, when it's used as a commodity and controlled in private hands, that the gouging, unrelenting greed that drives people to suffer and to deprive them of basic needs is in stark contrast to what the reality of money is as a utility. And what you've said and what you've illustrated so many times is that this is really a vehicle for us to make our lives work. It's the liquidity that we need to make our economies work. It seems to me that is a very good platform on which a politician should be able to run. President Trump violated a principal rule of Wall Street, didn't he? We're going to wipe out the debt. How do you think that's going to play out? He has Goldman Sachs all over his boardroom there, all over his cabinet.
Yeah, well, I saw they were already saying, well, he didn't really mean that. I mean, they're already trying to cover up that he said that. But it's just like Michael Hudson said, that debts that can't be paid won't be paid. I mean, it's just the reality of the situation. This is not going to get paid. But it does seem to me, like you're mentioning about not paying the interest, the vulture funds, one problem is you can't tell who the vulture funds are because they've got anonymity. And there's a bill on right now, I forget who brought it, to have transparency and who holds the debt. I mean, don't you think that's shocking that you can't even find out who holds your debt?
By the way, that's true in a municipal basis as well in cities. You try to look at who the sources are of capital and who's managing the funds and what the arrangements are, you have to scratch pretty deep, and sometimes the FOIA requests don't wash because it's contractually controlled or protected from disclosure.
Right, which seems to me shocking. I mean, if we, the taxpayers, are paying it, we should at least know
right. Who
we're paying. But so if you made that transparent and then not just the name, but the date of when they bought it and what they paid for it. And so when they're in bankruptcy court with this redoing their debt, just give people back the principal that they paid, not the interest that they're due in the future, but just give back what they haven't yet been paid in principal. Or you can figure out what they've been paid, and if they've gotten their money back, then they're done.
Right. If they've gotten their principal back, then, you know, let's move on, right?
Right, right.
And same is true in Detroit and Houston. Goodness sakes, man, you know, what are these places going to do for money? The insurance companies, I'm sure, will find a way to back out of their obligations as much as possible. And it'll also be interesting to observe who gets the better treatment by these banks. Will it be rich and white Napa and Sonoma, which are lovely, wonderful places, as was Puerto Rico, but just wondering how available money will be to help out. But let me ask you from a banking standpoint, Ellen. A bank holds assets that are now completely gone, either by flood or by fire, and that equity is part of their mortgage portfolio. They're going to, of course, go to the insurance companies. But how does a bank deal with that kind of catastrophic loss of its assets and its equity?
you know, I can remember reading some expert whose name I've forgotten, British. He got into so much trouble for his book, which I thought was brilliant, that he quit into hiding. But it's only a legal requirement that banks balance their books. You could just let them off the hook on this since they created the money in the first place. If, to the extent that loans come from a bank that created the money on its books, if there's a default, and it's really nobody's fault that there's a default, just you can either just let them carry that on their books, which is exactly what the Chinese are doing. You know, they have all these non-performing loans, and they very cleverly are saying, well, we don't want our banks to go bankrupt. We don't want them to stop lending. And so we're just going to let them carry these non-performing loans. We're just going to let them sit there. We're not going to declare that they're insolvent, and we're going to let them keep on operating. I mean, we just have this idea that because the books don't balance, that we've got to get the money from somewhere. But not really. You could just let it go. There's the moral hazard thing, where if you always let private banks get away with not having their books balanced, that they're going to abuse the privilege. But first of all, what if you made them public banks? You say, well, okay, we're not going to worry about those defaulted debts, but we're now going to nationalize you. You're going to be working for us, and therefore we're going to make sure we keep it honest. You know, not going to be doing risky things in the future, et cetera.
Well, I started out by saying that these are interesting times. This is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of our time now, is that money is going to be in great demand for exigencies, for emergencies, and a growing demand is not going to be satisfactorily met by the private capital interest. I just don't see how that's possible. So we are in a transformative time in how we look at money. Then, of course, you know, it's in its new forms as well. So there's lots to talk about our money, and I guess we'll just have to put that conversation on hold until our next program.
I just have one more comment.
Sure.
Well, if we're talking about all this devastation in Texas and so forth, there's a lot of work to be done, and that work will generate GDP. So you want to get money to the workers. It's kind of like Roosevelt's thing, you know, that if you had people dig ditches and if you paid them for digging ditches and filling them back in, you would stimulate the economy because you'd get money into the pockets of the workers, who could then spend it on GDP. If you have them actually rebuilding something that needs to be rebuilt, that's even better. There's a lot of work now to be done. All we need, the only thing we're missing, it's like that old joke about why was New Orleans never rebuilt, because they had the workers and they had the materials, but they didn't have the money. Well, what is the money? It's just little green pieces of paper that acknowledge that the work has been done. So anyway, it doesn't hurt to generate some extra money when you've got extra work that needs to be done. You're really paying for a real thing. It's not like putting money into the speculative economy that just creates bubbles. You're putting it into productivity.
Yeah, that's a good point to follow on, Ellen. Thanks for wrapping up that way. And I know your guest today, who's really an expert on the Fed, Tim Canova, will probably have many things to share about that as well. Well, thanks once again, Ellen. We'll see what happens next.
Great talking to you, as always.
As always.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Professor Tim Canova, who, among a very long list of achievements, is an expert on the Federal Reserve and its history. He is also currently a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives, challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida. It's a really interesting campaign, but since we're a 501c3, Public Banking Institute is a 501c3, and this is programs about public banking, we probably have to stick to the more mundane issues of banking and the Federal Reserve. So Tim is currently professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida, and has written dozens of articles and chapters in books, taught at a number of universities, served as legislative assistant to the late Senator Paul Tsongas, and served on an advisory committee put together by Senator Bernie Sanders. You also advised on an Occupy Wall Street movement in L.A., and we now have a Public Bank L.A. movement, so we may need your insights again. So anyway, it's great to be talking to you, Tim.
Thank you, Ellen. It's wonderful to be on your show. I appreciate it.
Okay, so on the mundane topics of the Federal Reserve, the Fed is now threatening to, or actually unwinding, their accommodations that they made earlier. So they've got like $3.7 trillion in securities on their books, which they're going to sell back into the market at the rate of $10 billion a month.
$10 billion a month. Yeah, you know, earlier this year, the Fed was actually purchasing more securities. Some folks were claiming it was kind of a hidden quantitative easing, a QE4. They did it for a couple of months, and they were buying bonds at a rate that was pretty much on track with what they had been doing on the QE3, $85 billion a month, I think. But I think they did that for the first quarter of the year, and then they stopped. And as you said, now they're talking about unwinding their positions and starting to sell their bond holdings.
Which to me seems like, first of all, it didn't do much good. Well, first of all, I don't think it's going to do anything, because what they did originally was move those bonds off the books of the banks and moved them onto the books of the Federal Reserve, and now they're going to move them the other way. It's not going to actually get into the real economy. But the problem is, it seems to me, is the interest. If you the mortgage-backed securities are fine, so give them back to the banks, great. But the federal securities, the Federal Reserve rebates the interest to the government, and private banks won't do that. So that's going to drive our interest rate up. Plus, the Fed at one point was talking about raising interest rates to 3.5%, which would have doubled the interest that we pay on the federal debt, like to $830 billion, I think I heard. So that's like
a year.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good chunk of, like, two-thirds of what we pay in income taxes. So anyway, yeah. It seems to me like raising interest rates is a dangerous thing to do. And anyway, I think they're operating from the wrong model. But what's your thought on
all that? Well, of course, I think you and I are pretty like-minded on this. I agree it's not a good time to be raising interest rates. What is the impetus for unwinding their position? I think it's complaints from wealth holders that they're not getting high enough rates of return on safe investments, treasury securities. And, you know, if you turn on CNBC or Bloomberg News, you're going to hear these folks always saying that interest rates are being suppressed and it's hurting the wealthy, and therefore it's going to hurt the economy. And they just seem to get it every way they want. The Fed steps in and has these enormous quantitative easing programs, and who's it helping? It's helping the wealth holders. It's not just pushing down interest rates, but it's really driving money, I think, into the securities markets. It's helping folks who are going to be purchasing at the very high end of real estate. It's propping up, a very top-heavy distribution of wealth. And then when it's time to, and then as if that's not enough, that they've really had their these hidden subsidies, they then complain that they're not getting a high enough rate of return, and Fed should unwind their positions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I totally agree that pushing interest rates so low helped to create bubbles in the stock market and in the housing market, but that's a different thing from buying securities off the books of the banks and giving them back, which doesn't seem to me to do very much. But anyway, then there's
I've called it a trickle down monetary policy. it props up those at the very top.
And right.
As they're doing better, it does have these side effects, not directly, but side effects to help boost security markets and high end real estate.
Speaking of writing, I also wrote my last two articles were on things the Fed could do. One would be to save Puerto Rico by doing just an extra round of QE3. Their debt is $70 billion, and QE3 was $85 billion. So in 1 month, they could easily rescue Puerto Rico without hurting the bondholders. President Trump said, we'd have to wipe that debt out, which shocked everybody, but we should wipe that debt out.
Yeah, I'm in strong agreement with you there. In fact, a year ago, when I was first running against Wasserman Schultz, I spoke with one of Bernie Sanders' Commerce Committee staff, somebody I'd worked with way back in 2010, on the legislation that became the Dodd-Frank Act, and in particular the provisions to provide greater transparency at the Fed and to have the Government Accountability Office do a couple of audits of the Fed, of its governance structure and its emergency lending facilities during the crisis. And we had spoken a year ago about Puerto Rico, in fact, and this, of course, is well before the hurricane, but still Puerto Rico was, its economy was melting down because of its debt crisis. And we were both in agreement that having the Federal Reserve step in and buy up a lot of that public sector debt could go a long way to helping Puerto Rico, and that it need not be just for Puerto Rico. You know, you take a look at major cities like Detroit. I think Bakersfield, California, was on the verge of bankruptcy. I can't recall if it actually filed. But, you know, you've had a lot of austerity at the state and local level in the United States. My view is that you've had a central bank that has come to the rescue of Wall Street, and that is to the tune of trillions of dollars. And if the same central bank were to help Main Street, and not with trillions of dollars of aid, but just maybe a couple hundred billion, it would go a long way to stopping a lot of this austerity and the privatizations that you see happening all over the country still.
Agreed. I've argued that they could make low interest loans to students, but then the rebuttal is, well, the reason they could do it for the banks, but they can't do it for the students, is that the banks are good pays. Well, the reason the banks are good pays is that they're underwritten by the federal government. But you could definitely say that about state and local governments. If they were getting virtually interest-free loans, or let's say, you know, the same rates that the banks are getting, even if it's 1% loans, that's better than what they're getting for their infrastructure now. They're doing 4 to 6%. They're perfectly good pays. There's no reason to think that state and local governments are going to go bankrupt with their infrastructure loans.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned pension funds earlier. You know, in the first couple of years during the financial crisis, we're talking about 2009 and 2010, the Fed made, I think the estimate was about $29 trillion of low-interest loans, loans at, I think, a roughly 0.25% interest rates to the big Wall Street banks, the hedge funds, the same institutions that brought us the mortgage bubble and collapse. The Fed didn't make loans at those kinds of rates to pension funds, to union trust funds. But for some reason, it was the banks and the hedge funds that got free money. And if the Fed had been giving that kind of, pushing that kind of free money into pension funds and union trust funds, those funds would be doing a lot better today. So it's very much been a Wall Street orientation of the Fed, and completely ignored the interests of Main Street. And it was different back in the 1930s and 40s. During the Great Depression, the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks actually made more than $100 million in loans directly to Main Street businesses, to corporations, partnerships that were, you know, industrial, not financial or banking in nature.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about infrastructure, you know, in the past that I've spoken about and written about the need for a national infrastructure bank, the United States is one of the only advanced industrial countries that does not have a national infrastructure bank. Japan and Germany and China, they all do. And the United States used to effectively have one, which was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that was started first under President Herbert Hoover. But when Franklin Roosevelt became president, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation got much more muscular, you could say, for Main Street. I think spent well over $50 billion. It was a big percentage of overall economic activity, and it helped build the country's infrastructure. You know, you name it, the kinds of bridges and roads and seaports and airports that we take for granted, a lot of it was built during the New Deal, and it was financed by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Yeah, and that's definitely what we should be doing again. You've got to get the money out there first before you can, you've got to pay the workers and materials before you have a product to sell or before you have a piece of infrastructure. I've often wondered, I can't find this, but I'm quite sure it's true, that like the infrastructure banks say in China just, if they want to build a railroad, they just do it, funding it with credit, like all banks do, and then they pay it back out of the proceeds. I'm assuming that's true, that the infrastructure banks just issue the money like any bank does. The Bank of England has said that banks do not lend their deposits. They actually create deposits when they make loans. So I'm assuming that all those infrastructure banks, when they build all this amazing infrastructure in Asia that or Africa or wherever they're building, that they're just issuing credit, basically.
Well, I'm not so sure of that. Of course, that makes the most sense to do it that way, but I'm not sure that is the way it's conducted. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation really was more of a revolving fund than a bank. It raised money in the capital market. It got very low interest rate money.
But most of their money was borrowed from the federal government, or they sold bonds to the federal government. And where did the federal government get the money? It's still, aren't they just going into debt? They ran up big debts during World War II.
Well, that's true. And the debt was basically at near zero interest rates for the federal government during that period of time. This is a period of time that is known as the pegged period, because the Federal Reserve was pegging yields on short-term treasuries at 0.375%. And I think at the long-term treasuries at barely over 2%. And they did that for, effectively, they were doing it in the 1930s. But after Pearl Harbor, they made it very official, you could say. And from 1941 to 1951 is really the pegged period. So the federal government essentially was getting free money from the Federal Reserve, pumping some of it into the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, spending a lot of it on the war and on post-war, whether you're talking about the Marshall Plan or the GI Bill of Rights. So it's hard to imagine how the federal government could have accomplished everything that it did during that decade if the Federal Reserve had not effectively been monetizing the debt and pushing free money into Treasury.
Right. Or you don't even have to call it that. They're just going into debt. But going into debt with whom? I mean, where is the money coming from? The deep pocket of the central bank. That's the way they fund every budget, right? If they go over budget, then they draw it from the Fed. I mean, they pay all their bills just by writing on their Fed account. And then at the end of the year, if they've gone over budget, then they feel compelled to issue bonds. But they wouldn't have to issue the bonds, really. I mean, they could just leave that debt sitting up there, and I'd argue it wouldn't hurt anything. I mean, I suppose arguably at some point you'd have too much money out there, and then you have to bring it back. But you don't.
But
have
you
to,
you bring it back through taxation.
Right. Right. Agreed. Speaking of which, I mean, we can't get into too political stuff, but I'd be interested to hear, let's assume hypothetically you happen to be in Congress, what sort of policies would you propose in terms of fixing our monetary system?
If folks go to our website at timcanova.com and go to the issues page, you'll see a really pretty well-developed issue statement. You know, what I'm calling for is a lot of the progressive agenda that you see being pushed by Bernie Sanders and others right now, which is certainly much more progressive taxation, Medicare for all. I'd like to see the federal government get involved in housing, and including investments in public housing and certainly investments in infrastructure on a mass scale. And to do that, I do think it makes sense to have some reforms of the Federal Reserve, including to reform the governance of the Fed, so that it's not just a captured agency that's captured by the big bankers, but that has more of a diversity of interests that are represented on the Federal Reserve's governing boards and policymaking committees. And, of course, as we've already discussed, I think it's high time for a national infrastructure bank as well. In 1992, candidate Bill Clinton campaigned for a federal infrastructure bank. And in 2008, candidate Barack Obama campaigned for a federal infrastructure bank, but they get in there and it suddenly disappears from their agenda. And
somebody takes them into a little room and shows them a video of the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, I've heard that theory before. There's little doubt that both of those Democratic administrations were heavily influenced by Wall Street. You take a look at who was appointed to the top positions in the administration, and it's like a revolving door between Wall Street and Treasury and the Fed, and some of the same characters who were the architects of all the financial deregulation under Bill Clinton resurfaced in the Obama administration right away, including Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner.
It is a conundrum. I mean, how do we? I write and write and write, and you do your best, and you're obviously totally well intentioned. But how do we move this thing off the? I mean, clearly Congress is not doing the will of the people. I don't think anybody really wants to spend more than half the budget on the military, or to be in all those places we are militarily, or fighting all those wars we're fighting. But they're not listening to us.
You know, on issue after issue, it shows that Congress, I think there was a report that came out, a study by some Princeton University professors a year or two ago, and it showed that to the degree that the American people are, you know, have supermajority support for certain policy positions, it's actually less likely, not more likely, that Congress will legislate there, that they'll enact the will of the people. So the problem is really a political problem. I never thought I'd run for a political office. I do think that when you look at Bernie Sanders' campaign last year, it started to open up this space for folks like me to step up and try to make a difference, try to get involved in the political system. But I don't see how we address any of the problems that are pressing right now. Millions of people who don't have health care. Millions of people who don't have good job opportunities, and, you know, declining and stagnant incomes, environmental problems, you name it, the whole range of issues, you can't address them as long as Washington is ruled by big corporate money and dark money from, you know, billionaires. So campaign finance reform really has to be at the very top of the agenda. And, you know, that's why last year and this year I'm running against Wasserman Schultz, and I pledged not to take any corporate money whatsoever. And it's tough. It's tough to do it this way, to raise money in small donations, mostly online. We were very successful last year in raising, I think it was almost $3.8 million, and they were all in small individual contributions. I think we had the highest percentage of contributions of $200 or less of any campaign in history at that point. So the question is, how do you reform the system and overturn decisions like Citizens United? There are constitutional amendments that have been introduced in Congress right now in both the House and the Senate. And I support those amendments, but there's not much of a chance of them moving. First of all, even if the Democrats control the House and Senate, those are Democrats that have reached their positions because of corporate campaign contributions. And even if you could get that party united behind overturning Citizens United, to do it through a constitutional amendment requires a 2/3 vote of the House, a 2/3 vote of the Senate, and then 3/4 of the states to pass it. That's a very tough lift. And, you know, there is a provision in the Constitution, I think it's Article 3, Section 2, that allows Congress to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. And it was put in the Constitution for this type of a situation where the Supreme Court has gone completely off the rails. And I would like to see Congress pass legislation to overturn Citizens United that strips the court of the jurisdiction to hear any cases challenging Congress's regulation of corporate money. Corporations should not be considered people under the First Amendment, and money should not be equated with speech.
I totally agree with that. Well, I think it's marvelous that you did run. I mean, I ran for state treasurer in California.
I recall.
That was really tough, and I wasn't trying to win. I was just trying to make a statement. Luckily, I see you're an athlete that you hurdled 572 garbage cans on an 8-mile run.
I did do that once. Yes,
I saw that on your page.
I am known as the hurdler. That was some years ago.
Yeah, so you've got the stamina to do it. So I think it'll be wonderful if you get in there and do it. But I agree. I don't know how we can possibly move a very corrupt. It's either corrupt or corruptible or bribable or frightened.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but you wouldn't think that 500 people could all be corrupted, but it looks that way. Or else they just don't understand the issues.
I think the system corrupts even the best of intentioned individuals. When I was running last year, 60 Minutes had an episode that dealt with the way candidates for Congress raise campaign money. And they go to these call centers, and there's a call center right there on Capitol Hill that has Republicans and Democrats both using the same facilities, calling their list of wealthy donors and asking for money. And it's not an insignificant amount of time they're spending doing this. 60 Minutes estimated that on average, these candidates were spending 30 hours a week dialing for dollars.
Wow.
And if you spend that kind of money week in, week out, month in, month out, talking to only wealthy folks to ask them for money and to hear what their concerns are, you start looking at the world through their eyes. And you start losing touch with the people, and you start justifying it that, well, it's better to get a half a loaf. It's better to get a quarter of a loaf. It's better to get some crumbs. And that's just the way the system works. But it's not the way the system should work. And, you know, I think what we have going for us is that, you know, public opinion wants change. I look at this last election that brought Trump to the White House, and I don't think it was a left versus a right, right election or a Republican versus Democrat. Trump, I think it was a lie, but he was perceived as the outsider, and it was outsiders versus insiders. And when I say it was a lie, it turned into one, of course. I mean, he has surrounded himself and his cabinet with just billionaires, and it's the same old swamp and insiders so far. There's not been a lot of change, I think, for the better. But the American people want change, and I think we weren't that far off from seeing something very significant. You know, Bernie Sanders almost took down the strongest political machine perhaps in our country's history. And the Democratic Party is in a state of civil war. Progressives are stepping up all over the country to start challenging incumbent Democrats. And this is all good. I just think as things deteriorate, and it just seems like we go from bad to worse, there's bound to be a tipping point where change comes.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, that's happening globally, too. If you look at Catalonia, for example, mm-hmm. declaring independence from Spain, and the Italians are talking about a dual money system where they'd basically be issuing their own money. I mean, Brexit movement, et cetera, there's a lot of, I think people are, in general, are waking up. I mean, they've got the internet now, and so you can't keep people blinded to the issues through the mass media, because people just don't go to they see through the mass media, and they go to their alternative media, which maybe isn't reliable, but it's kind of like Donald Trump. You know, it may be like totally erratic, but you have the freedom to. I mean, at least there's some hope there of seeing something different or seeing what's really going on. And I can remember I had a friend who was in World War II, and I said something about he was talking about, you know, that we were right. And I said, well, what about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And he said, well, you have to realize that we were told by the media that these were slant-eyed devils, that they were all bad, basically. And they could get away with that then, but now you've got the internet where we can see the Japanese, we can see the Chinese, we can see the Middle Easterns in their homes, you know, doing normal things, being normal, real human beings, just like us. And so we can no longer be told that some whole group of people are the enemy and actually believe that.
Well, I hear you. It's hard to fool all the people all the time. And I do agree that the internet has opened up lots of possibilities. The web has. It certainly is what fueled my campaign. I couldn't have raised all that money without the internet. But even with the internet, I mean, how many folks were aware that President Obama was bombing 7 countries at a time during the last few years of his administration? I think I just read one study that said on average he was dropping 72 bombs a day on these countries. And, you know, try naming the countries, a lot of folks wouldn't be able to. So there's a lot of information at our fingertips, but there's also, it's such a flood of information that it's easy to get overwhelmed and perhaps difficult to focus on any particular issues at any time, which is why I think campaigns are so important. You know, when Sanders was running, it really got everybody to start looking at the problems, the same problems at the same time. And I think he's still doing a good job of that. He's done a lot to push forward the idea of a Medicare for all, a single payer system. I know he just came out with an initiative the other evening for tuition-free higher education. I think he was due to debate Ted Cruz on it. So I do think that while it's easy to sort of throw up our hands and say both parties are corrupt and the system is corrupt, and I don't disagree with those assessments, we still have to, the response has to be to get more engaged, not less engaged.
Yeah, agreed. And I think it's marvelous that you're so engaged. You set a good example for the rest of us. And so of course, did Bernie Sanders. Well, even look at Donald Trump. I mean, people say he had plenty of money. He could just be enjoying himself. He doesn't need to be, right. He doesn't need to put up with all this. But there's, so it's great that we've got all these models of people like Jeremy Corbyn, et cetera, of people willing to challenge the system now. So just getting back to one more point on the Federal Reserve. So Janet Yellen may be on her way out and somebody else will be on their way in. Do you have an opinion on how the Fed's going to go?
I've seen some of the names. I think there was a piece a week ago or so that mentioned two or three people that Trump was interviewing. Yellen was on the list, but I sense she was on the list just out of courtesy, perhaps. It sounded like the people he was looking at were the same old Wall Streeters. So I'm not optimistic that there's going to be major change at the Fed under Trump.
Right. So what I've read, too, that they might be going in the other direction, you know, making it worse. And Janet Yellen was, in some ways, you know, a reasonable person. I don't know. I mean, I liked her. She's certainly personable compared to some other people that might be there.
Well, my question is this. When you hear Yellen testifying before Congress some months ago, she was talking like that we're near full employment and therefore it's just about time to start raising those interest rates and unwinding the Fed's bond holdings. And I don't know, I look at this economy and it doesn't seem like it's anywhere near full employment.
No.
The official unemployment rate is down in the low fours, but, you know, of course, it doesn't count all those people who are working a couple of part-time jobs or more to try to make ends meet, and those who have just gotten discouraged and stopped looking for full-time work. So if you had a real honest unemployment rate, it would be easily twice as high for the economy overall. And it also doesn't tell us the quality of those jobs. I mean, people could be working, but if their incomes are stagnant or falling, why would you want to conclude that we're anywhere near full employment?
Right. And if you put money into something like infrastructure, you just pump money out there to see what can be done with it. Put it into research and development. There's so many possibilities that it's just not just a matter of keeping the people fed or what, you know, doing the minimum to get everybody have a job and pay the rent, but that we're on the cusp of an era when we have all these potential developments that, you know, I mean, robots can do a lot that won't even count in unemployment.
Exactly. We're entering into a period of automation when they estimate within two or three decades, most jobs that human beings are engaged in right now will be obsolete, that there'll be machines doing them, you know, artificial intelligence, which, you know, you could look at it as a doomsday scenario where we're all going to be unemployed. Or you could look at it as a great opportunity for a basic minimum income, for people to be freed up, not just for leisure, but for all kinds of other pursuits in the arts and you name it, that we're not tied to the drudgery of a job. But,
right. And if you want to, people say, well, people will sit around and just, you know, take drugs or something, you know, waste their time. But I think the reason people sit around and take drugs or drink beer or whatever after work is that they're so wasted. They need, you know, they're so exhausted mm-hmm. from their daily grind and so bored with it that they need mm-hmm. an escape. I tried at one point in my life to get up in the morning early, write for a couple of hours, you know, my creative part of my brain, and then go mm-hmm. off to work as a lawyer, and then come home and deal with these two cute little kids that I really would have loved to spend a lot of attention on.
A lot more time.
But exactly. By the time I got home, I was absolutely wiped out. There was no way I could do all that. So if you want people to really manifest their potential, like creative things they might be able to do, they've got to do it first thing, and you know, not after their 8 hours of work, but that has to be their prime time.
Absolutely.
Been really great talking to you. Is there anything else you'd like to let
well
people know?
We touched on so much, and you know, earlier you asked if I were elected hypothetically, what would I be working on, and I think you get an idea. You know, political reform is a big part of it, but the other part of it is to push for this kind of full employment model. You know, I always talk about the New Deal and the GI Bill as models. And, of course, you can't just take what was done in the 1930s or 40s or 50s and, you know, have it be the complete answer for today. You'd have to update it for our present circumstances, a more globalized environment and higher tech and automation. But, you know, those programs, the New Deal programs, actually put people to work. And the GI Bill made sure that folks had adequate income and housing and health care. And those are still the human needs that we see today that are very unfulfilled. And it's having an impact on the environment. I know you're out in California where the forest fires have just been raging and to the point where people are being killed and homes are lost. You look back at the New Deal and the first jobs program, I think it was within days of Roosevelt taking office, Congress passed the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. And, you know, within 90 days, I think 250,000 young Americans were actually out in the field in the nation's parks and forests. And what were they doing? They were basically clearing underbrush, cutting fire lines, putting out fires when they were small before they got big. And, you know, basically it was drought and flood control and conservation. And I think this generation is overdue for all of that.
Mm-hmm. And one argument about what keeps the military so big is that so many people have jobs in the military. It's actually our biggest socialist program.
That's
but
right.
What you could do is bring all those boys home and do, like you said, have them be working on our infrastructure and our, you know, all those things that need to be done in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And of course, now it's not just boys, it's boys and girls.
Right, so. Right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to my own sex. Yeah. Well, and I always marvel, like we were in the city hall a week or so ago for a public banking thing, and the beautiful architecture that they did in the 30s. I mean, it wasn't just that they were slapping together buildings. They were actually
exactly.
doing art that
I know.
Nobody has
art,
the time
art.
For now, but they could fund that then.
Art,
when
art
they were
culture.
Broke, like a time in our history when we were absolutely broke. How did we manage to put up all those beautiful buildings?
Exactly. You look at, and that was the Works Projects Administration, the WPA. And they weren't just building that heavy infrastructure. They were doing that. The big bridges and tunnels and airports and seaports
Damn.
And school buildings and hospitals, they did all that. But they also employed hundreds of thousands of writers and artists and musicians. And they were producing culture, basically. And we don't do that anymore. We've got the resources. This is the wealthiest country, even for all of its problems. We've got the most wealth in one country ever, as far as we know, in human history. And there's so much more that we should be doing. And I think most folks, most people realize that this has been a raw deal, that the wealthy keep getting wealthier. The statistics on the distribution of wealth and income are just crazy. How much of the mm-hmm. money is flowing to the very top. And I don't just mean the top 10%. I mean like the top 1% or 0.1% are really the ones making a killing right now. And they have been for quite a while.
It's the exponential function. I mean, it just gets snowballs and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So you've got this giant parasite that's just sucking all the assets out of
exactly.
out of the real economy. We're supporting two economies, the speculative economy and the real productive economy.
Well, you know, you've written so much about this, and you've been really an inspiration to me and so many others. And that goes back to your Web of Debt and then your book on public banking. And I was just thrilled to hear that you're working with the public banking folks in LA. I've been out there to LA a couple of times in the past few months for campaign events and to meet with supporters, you know, just grassroots supporters. And I was so thrilled to see the kind of progress that's being made by Public Banking LA and Divest LA as well. I remember way back in 2011 when I was trying to lobby LA City Hall on infrastructure to try to get the mayor at the time, Villaraigosa, who headed the National Conference of Mayors, to get on board our proposal to call for the Federal Reserve to pump free money into the California Infrastructure Bank and state infrastructure banks all over the country. And it was like talking to a wall. It was very hard to get past his political aides and, you know, to get them very interested in this proposal. And during those weeks, while we were pushing this proposal, we walk out of LA City Hall, or we walk in there, and suddenly there's a tent city around LA City Hall. And it was the beginning of the Occupy LA movement. And Occupy LA did have some real successes, I think, in jumpstarting their divest movement to divest from the big banks, to get people to change their banking out of Wells Fargo and other big banks. And it just seems like, even though that's years ago and Occupy LA is, you know, a distant memory, I suppose, it was very inspiring to see so many folks from Divest LA and Public Banking LA who haven't given up the fight at all. And it looks like Los Angeles could be leading the country down the road for public banking in the future at this point.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting, and it's really not the same people. It's the young people. We have a whole new wave of supporters, which is marvelous. They've got so much enthusiasm and dedication.
Absolutely. Yeah, I noticed that, too. You know, when I was out there at Occupy LA, they were a lot of young folks, but that's how many years ago now? 6 years ago since Occupy, you know, and the folks that I met who are involved in public banking and Divest LA, you're right, it's a new wave of young folks. I know you're an inspiration to a lot of them, so I really applaud what you've been doing for many years, Ellen.
Okay, likewise to you. You're out there hurdling garbage cans.
Fighting the machine at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's been so great talking to you. Do you want to give some details for people who are interested in following up?
Yeah, it'd be great if folks could go to timkanova.com, and you'll see lots of opportunities to see what our agenda is all about. The issues page is real important, and ways that folks can actually help our campaign. And, you know, it's so important for folks to spread the word if they do get excited about my campaign, because, again, we weren't raising money and we're not raising money from political action committees and super PACs and all that. It's literally just small donations, but when you multiply it by thousands and thousands of small donations, it makes an enormous difference.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, thank you so much, and the best of good luck and all that.
Thank you, Ellen. You take care.
I've been speaking with Tim Canova, a professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida and a candidate for U.S. House of Representatives.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with